It's great to be here and to have listened to the previous presentations, and a lot of it bears on the sort of specific example that I'll talk about at the FDA in terms of how do we, either through legislation or policy or through steps taken at the FDA itself, restore both its independence and its transparency. And I'm going to talk specifically about a couple of aspects of that have to do with financial conflicts of interest. When we think about the question of independence, this is just a short version from the dictionary, talking about having an agency, in this case thinking of the Food and Drug Administration, one that's not subject to control by others, that's not affiliated with a larger controlling unit, that's not requiring or relying on something else, not looking to others for one's opinions or for guidance and conduct, not bound by or committed to a political party. And although this, obviously, bits and pieces of that, you know, are relevant or not relevant to a government agency, I think it's a sort of the theme of how do we have an agency that is bound by law, it is bound by regulation that it creates, it is bound by the mission. How do we still ensure that it can act as independently as possible when, as a science-based agency, a public health agency, it needs to retain its scientific independence? In terms of financial independence, there are several things to look at FDA. One is its financial independence of through appropriations. Does it get direct funds adequate enough to assure that it can carry out its mission? Where are the funds coming from? In this case, can we have limits on the user fees, which FDA is dependent upon for its resources? And how do we reduce conflicts of interest? I think there are obviously other aspects of independence from outside pressure, whether it's political intervention or pressure from industry, direct intervention, that also need to be considered and addressed. But I'm going to spend today talking primarily about financial independence and how we can go from there. The Institute of Medicine said in 2006 on its study on drug safety system, an agency whose crucial mission is to protect and advance the public health should not have to go begging for resources. The FDA is an agency that does not just review and approve or disapprove new drugs. It is also responsible for the safety and effectiveness of new biologic products, and the safety of the blood supply. It is also responsible for ensuring the manufacturing of these products, so inspecting the manufacturing and the study sites as well around the world. It is also responsible for medical devices and equipment that emits radiation, so it's everything from things that are implanted in your hip or your heart to mammography facilities, to the microwave ovens, to the computer terminal, all medical devices, again, ranging from approving new ones to monitoring the safety of these products on the market, as well as the manufacturing of them around the world. You add on to that the food supply, the safety of food that is transported across international borders as well as across state lines, the manufacturing of processed foods, everything except meat and poultry. So that includes seafood and testing for contamination. It includes, again, produce and processed foods to ensure the safety of the food supply, both in terms of contamination but also in terms of deliberate bioterrorism. This is the mission of the FDA. It is very broad. It is very deep. And the agency, frankly, doesn't have the resources to carry out its job. So at a certain point, the FDA became dependent upon user fees for particularly focused on the product review cycle. So the part of a limited piece of the FDA budget and the FDA mission, which is the review of new products, the new funding from user fees is limited to that portion, but it had effects on the entire agency as that was the best funded part of the agency. I point out that about 80% of FDA's budget is salaries. We're talking about people, reviewers, scientific staff. There are about 10,000 employees. They are also inspectors of manufacturing plants and products all over the country and all over the world. And most of the scientific staff there, of which there are about 6,000, about 1,000 responded, did not believe that FDA had the resources to effectively perform its mission. This survey was done about a year ago, and I think it's just as applicable today. This graphic comes from the New York Times last January or so, and points out the sort of relative amount of expenditures that we have placed on, in this case, looking at the FDA. If you look at, this is an underestimate of the war. If you look at the cost of some of the universal health care plans that are out there, they are around $100 billion or so. Preschool, universal, and implementing the 9/11 Commission recommendations. This is about the NCI budget as a fraction of the whole of the NIH budget, and of course immunizations. Now, where does FDA fall here? It's right about here. It's about $1.4 billion, and it carries out the responsibilities that I described: the food supply, the medicines, medical devices and products, the blood supply, and so forth, from manufacturing through to ensuring and monitoring the safety of these products once they're on the market. So it's really extraordinary when we talk about, you know, adding on $100 billion or so here, when the entire annual budget for FDA is around $1.5 billion. PDUFA is the acronym for the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. There's also a MDUFA, Medical Device User Fee Act. There are a couple others in play as well, but these are the two big ones, PDUFA being the biggest. And the FDA, four FDA commissioners were together last February and asked, given a choice of having PDUFA or a direct appropriation of equal amount, which would you take? And all of them agreed that they would much rather have direct appropriations. Not because they necessarily will say that the user fees sway decisions, it's just cleaner. And it makes it clear that the FDA is working for the American public. There's also have been impacts of PDUFA, because the User Fee Act not only constrained money, but it also constrained how that money was used. It constrains how the timelines that are placed on reviewers to quickly review a product, to be able to, if reaching the point of approval, to approve it in a timely fashion. And it is, resources have a direct impact on how quickly reviewers can review a new medical product. With more resources, time it takes to go through the data decreases. And this association came before the User Fee Act came into place. So what the User Fee Act did was just supply the additional resources necessary. And you can see that the decline in the approval times, done by a study by Dan Carpenter at Harvard, showed that it was attributable to PDUFA, except through this additional resources that came in. But the clock that was placed on reviewers, again, had consequences. So although things came faster, they would have come faster if the money had come from somewhere, from anywhere, it actually has consequences on reviewer behavior. All of a sudden, a deadline is put into place, along with sort of a string attached to the money that comes from the user fees, and indeed, people tend to make the decision immediately prior to that deadline, and very few trickle out because there are consequences in their performance reviews or their evaluations as reviewers if they haven't met the deadlines. So, and it also seems to affect the decisions, and that the rate of which drugs experience post-marketing regulatory events. So that includes label changes, perhaps additional warnings, perhaps new adverse events being added. It's appreciably higher for the drugs that are approved just before the deadline, as opposed to those that get approved a little bit later than the deadline. And I think that, again, tells us this rush to judgment can have consequences. Then the reason there was a rush to judgment is because the industry is able to insist upon deadlines as they provide the funding to the agency. So I think all of these have consequences in how the agency functions, both in terms of the quantity of the work, but also the quality of the work. I'm going to switch now and talk about the outside influence of conflicts of interest, about FDA advisory committees. FDA does seek outside expert advice at the call of the agency. The advice is not mandatory. The recommendations are not binding on the FDA. But they are selected and paid for by FDA, but they, you know, work in academia or in research or consumer or patient representatives, or indeed there are official industry representatives who serve on the advisory committee. They have four-year terms, and these meetings are open to the public and to the press. So there is transparency, and discussions are only to take place during those advisory committee public sessions. The data that comes in for evaluation is from the product sponsor, but it's also from an analysis done by the FDA reviewers as well. And then members will discuss and vote about a product and determine whether it should be approved. But again, they just make recommendations to the FDA. FDA holds the decision-making policy, although, as is always stated, it usually follows the advice of its advisory committees. Now, there's been some analysis of who serves on the FDA advisory committees. And there are each division or product type has its own standing advisory committee to which other people can be added. And Peter Lurie and others examined the advisory committees that met between 2001 and 2004 and found that quite a number of them had at least one member with a conflict of interest. 22% had more than half of their members conflicted. And 41% of these conflicts were with the sponsoring company. But there is a great variability and a big range of conflicts depending on the particular advisory committee that was convening. So there was a lower amount in reproductive and urologic drugs, higher one in anesthetic and life support drugs. And a number of the committees, 7 out of the 16 drug advisory committees, had less than 20%. So it is possible to have fairly low participation by those who are conflicted. But there has been this continued concern that increasing not just the members of the advisory committee, but those also the public who testify or provide public comment during the public comment session of the meeting turn out to be conflicted as well. Either their travel expenses have been paid, or their research is supported, or they have been provided consulting or honoraria, et cetera. So similar to the people who are. So there's also this concern about what's happening in the public side as well as on the expert side that's on the advisory committee itself. But the question comes in, can conflicts alter the voting behavior? And it's not always clear. In the paper I've been discussing, there was really no clear way to document that the conflicts would have changed. If you'd excluded the members of the with conflicts, it would not necessarily have changed the overall vote outcome in terms of majority vote, although it might have shifted the discussion. And I think an important point was made earlier, which was that even if you have, you exclude the people are not voting, but they're participating, they can be the person there who is the particular expert in that particular question, and they lead the tone, and they shape the discussion because they are thought leaders and are opinion leaders. And so it's a bit unmeasurable, and so I think it just remains a question because it's very difficult to say, except in a couple of cases, including the COX-2 inhibitors case, where the conflicted members had been excluded, two of the three COX inhibitors that were recommended to stay on, COX-2 inhibitors, which were recommended to stay on the market by the advisory committee, would have been recommended to be pulled off the market. So there are some cases, but it's very difficult to tease out. And so it remains a problem. But then if you take a step back and say, how much should we really have to worry about this? Aren't there just enough people out there who do have the expertise? This question of can you have an unbiased or has to be either biased and qualified have to come together. In fact, there's a huge pool of experts here in the United States. Currently, the FDA only needs less than 500 advisory committee members to fill all of its committees. There are 125 medical schools in the United States and over 123,000 medical school faculty. So this is not including the community clinicians, but speaking of people who are on medical school faculty, over 4,000 pharmacy faculty, over 7,000 public health faculty. And so to find less than 500 experts should be doable, who do not have financial conflicts of interest, even if you presume half of the pool has financial conflicts. That leaves many thousand more than you need, tens of thousands of people out there to recruit from as a pool. And of course, NIH is a huge funder as a public funder of research. And although many people get both NIH grants and industry grants, indeed, the NIH-funded pool is a resource that we should be drawing on. Right now, there is a new FDA guidance that came out in March of this year that began to limit the conflicts of interest of advisory committees. I think that sort of seeing that this reality was coming to bear on the agency, FDA issued a new guidance. They now establish a threshold of $50,000. This is a draft guidance, not in play at the moment. But if the interest is over $50,000, then essentially the person is excluded from any participation. If a conflict is less than $50,000, they can only participate if the determination, the need outweighs the conflict. So a waiver would be granted. However, that waiver would allow them to participate but not to vote on the committee. So it would pull away the vote from anyone with a financial conflict of interest. So this actually is a significant step forward, except that participation role is still there, that ability to engage in the conversation, to engage in the evaluation of the data, to persuade colleagues on the panel that in one direction or another. So that participation role is still there. At around the same time, Congress was taking up the FDA Amendments Acts of 2007. And in there is, for the first time, a recognition in the law that reducing conflicts of interest towards zero is a good thing. It did not establish a no-waiver standard, but rather called for several things. First of all, and I think very important, is the issue of increased recruitment, to begin to reach out more to academia and organizations and to make nomination and self-nomination to be on advisory committees easier, to make it to work with different professional organizations and the academic world to see service on an FDA advisory committee as something for which you get credit as an academic researcher, so that you get the brownie points towards tenure for serving on FDA advisory committee, so it's seen as a benefit to the participant. Other than being able to be a consultant, more easily a consultant to industry, we would like it to have other benefits as well. And connecting to the federal grantee systems that are out there, NIH, CDC, and ARC, the Veterans Health Administration, to try and, again, identify the pool of people who have fewer conflicts or hopefully no conflicts at all, and begin to limit the number of waivers each year as it goes on, and to require disclosure of the waivers at least 15 days in advance. Right now, those waivers are not disclosed until almost immediately beforehand. And FDA, indeed, has just yesterday announced a new guidance saying that they will now disclose all waivers 15 days in advance. And again, much more annual reporting requirements to Congress to, again, disclose to Congress how many waivers, how many times is FDA letting those conflicts, the people with financial conflicts of interest, serve on committees, and on which committees are they serving, to help, again, improve the transparency. The FDA Amendments Act of 2007 was signed into law this year, this September. It continued the Prescription Drug User Fee Act and the Medical Device User Fee Act because it, frankly, is a source of funding for the agency that the appropriations Congress was not going to appropriate directly, and therefore it was a necessary requirement in order to keep the agency funded and not lead to layoffs within the FDA. But there are other provisions in it as well. As I mentioned, the limitations on conflicts of interest. There are some provisions protecting the rights of scientists to publish. There are provisions increasing the transparency of decision-making within the FDA. And there is some expansion of resources, although only via the user fee system. There's a lot in there, and there's a lot left to be done. But there was some of these incremental pieces began to allow for increased transparency, but the battles on how to truly make the agency transparent and independent remain real, and unfortunately, I'm not quite sure how they'll be tackled until this bill is taken up again in 5 more years. But I think there's a lot to be done and a lot of vigilance, as was mentioned earlier, to make sure that the implementation of the transparency and other provisions that are there are actually followed through, and that we actually begin to work with agencies like the FDA to help ensure that we can indeed recruit people to serve on advisory committees and work at the FDA without financial conflicts of interest.
Just speak up a little loud. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Please repeat the question.
Yeah, the question is that the policies generally apply to only to the individual researchers or other individual experts and not to the institutions that they work for, either universities or companies, et cetera. I mean, if they are employed directly by a company, that would that level of institution. But if it's an academic institution, the policies tackled here do not get to that question at all. It gets solely to the research support, the stock ownership, the consulting, the other financial conflicts of interest that apply to the individual and to their immediate family. And I guess in the IARC consideration, they were talking about their research unit. But at least at FDA, it does not tackle the larger institutional resources and where do they come from, unless it's actually a corporate entity.
Further questions? How about over here, please? Then we'll take you next.
Well, I think that's what the FDA is now directed to do, active recruitment. It has been the question was, how do we get to people who are not conflicted, because those with conflicts are actually probably promoted by the company's interests who help support, provide them. Right now, it's a very passive system inside FDA where the nominations, come up with the best of all intentions. I don't think the staff inside FDA don't want people with financial conflicts of interest, but they neither have the resources nor the priority placed on casting a broad net. So it's a very narrow net that's cast. People they know, people who are nominated, people who are put forward, people who come to meetings and they get to know, then they get nominated, they get self-nominated, or the committee or the staff put forward their name as a possibility. And I think it's because it's a very passive system. What we're trying to create now under the law, and hopefully in FDA's response to the law, is that FDA is now directed to be very active in recruitment. And so it's going to have to do that work of actually communicating and connecting with the academic research community in a very broad way, putting a system in place that is user-friendly, putting the collaborations between the different, again, the colleges, of professional colleges, as well as the universities themselves, to say, we want to somehow work together. It will take an effort, it will take resources, it will take time, and we'll see how it works.
It's another question right here. Yes, please.
The question is about the potential idea of user fees for setting up regulation of tobacco. Were FDA to be given the authority to regulate tobacco, it would probably come with user fees to help pay for it. I can't answer that question specifically, but rather to pull it in together with the sort of the principle, the underlying flaws of user fees. Right now, again, they're a necessary source of funding. I honestly don't think that the staff inside FDA see themselves as working for industry, but unfortunately, they are pressured because of the strings that come with it. So what I would argue is that if you have to have user fees at all, what is I think unique with regard to user fees with FDA, if someone knows differently, please let me know, is that the user fee is the FDA sits down and negotiates directly under the instruction of Congress to sit down and negotiate not only the amount of the money but how the money is to be used. And it is a negotiation, and then that there's a signed agreement, and then that is presented to Congress, and Congress then can pass the law that accepts the agreement, essentially. And in that sense, industry itself gets to directly negotiate in a very hard-nosed kind of way what they're paying for. Unlike other user fee systems where the regulated industry itself doesn't get to sit down and negotiate essentially in private with the regulator and determine how the money is to be spent. This has had consequences far beyond just how the money is spent, but on how other money gets spent inside FDA as well. It's had a ripple effect on the rest of the agency. But the key point is that there should not be a negotiation with the regulated industry. If the fee is to be assessed, it is to be assessed for X amount, and the agency gets to determine how it is to be spent, what are the priorities, what are the needs of the agency to carry out its mission, and so forth. And unfortunately, that's not the method that's been set up now. So if a new user fee gets added for tobacco, first of all, I would hope that's not the source of funding for that. Secondly, I would say if it is the source of funding for that, it should be a completely, the industry pays the money in and, is not part of the decision making on how it is used. That should be left up to the public health professionals, the scientists, and others inside FDA who determine the needs of the agency in order to carry out its mission as directed under the law.
Any other questions for any of our three speakers? Let's take over here, please. Yes. Please. Yes. The woman with her. Right.
Yeah, there was a. This is actually long prior to when emergency contraception came before that committee, but the Reproductive Health Advisory Committee had lapsed during, because it hadn't been convened for a number of years, and so they needed to repopulate it in early 2000. Actually, at the time when the women's around early 2000, like 2002, when the Women's Health Initiative came out about hormone therapy and menopause, there was thought that we might need to have a Reproductive Health Advisory Committee, and we better make sure we put together a committee. And indeed, during that period, there was some very unusual activity to normally, and maybe it's not always a perfect, it's certainly not a perfect model because it's that very passive appointment system. Normally, the reviewers and the FDA staff in a particular division put together a panel, essentially, and move it up the chain for sign-off by the powers that be up the chain. And that's how it's done. For this panel only, as far as I'm aware, a panel was submitted up the chain in sort of a usual fashion, and names were taken off and names were added from the very top, leading to a great deal of controversy. In fact, the chair was changed from the person nominated by the professional staff at FDA to Dr. David Hager, who was an extremely controversial appointment. Ultimately, Dr. Hager was not the chair, but he remained as a member of the committee, and another chair was appointed who was, quite well qualified, Dr. Linda Jadish. So there was a quite a unfortunate series of unusual events that led to the creation of that panel. And although ultimately that panel was largely populated by people with a great deal of relevant expertise, there were several members who came on for quite unusual reasons.
We have time for one last question for any of our panelists. Yes. Just speak a little louder, please.
Yep. It's really hard. Yeah, so the question comes, and it's important that this person actually works at FDA and knows the reality of trying to persuade people to serve on advisory committees. I think there has to be benefits, and this is why I say reaching out for them to serve. So it's not just I'm doing a favor for FDA, but where, you know, NIH has to get people to serve on study sections, you know, part of it is, well, it's part of what you owe back. It's part of what the academic world and the research community feels it owes back to NIH, and you get credit as an academic for having worked, you know, done your time, you know, doing a study section at NIH. But you don't get that kind of credit for being on an advisory panel. The benefit you get, frankly, is, as I mentioned earlier, you become much more marketable to industry if you've served on an advisory committee. But if that's not your interest, if your interest is just doing whatever it is you do and you don't have financial conflicts of interest and you're not interested in making money off your service as an FDA advisor somewhere down the line, at this point you're doing it out of a real altruistic sense and a real sense of I'm doing the right thing. You're not getting many pats on the back. You're not getting any kind of recognition that this is seen as a good thing. So I think working with the universities and the organizations of the academic research community and the professional organizations, that takes people. That takes people and time and work. And whether FDA has gotten enough additional resources to actually carry it out, I would probably say no. But they have gotten the direction from Congress to do it, so it's going to be one of those struggles. You've got an instruction but no funding at this point to carry it out.